Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance here at Texas A&M. I am your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we are always pleased to bring you another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine and human performance, and this week is no exception. We have Dr. Marielle England with us today. Welcome to the podcast, Marielle.
Thank you, Tim.
I'm going to tell everybody a little bit about you, and then we'll just jump right into the conversation.
Will you? Sure, that's fine.
Okay. Marielle is an associate professor and a co-director of the Center for Translational Research on Aging and Longevity here at Texas A&M. She has multiple degrees. She has a PhD in physiology from Maastricht University in Maastricht, Netherlands. She did a postdoctoral fellowship in the Department of Respiratory Medicine at Maastricht University. She was awarded the American Society for Nutrition's Vernon Young International Award for Amino Acid Research. And she was also a research associate scientist with Carl Wasserman at UCLA. And many people listening to this podcast will remember Dr. Wasserman, who was always quite an influential member of the exercise science community here in the United States for many years. So again, welcome so much to the podcast, Mario.
Thank you, Tim.
We're so glad to have you. You've been doing a lot of work with respiration and nutrition.
Yes, and, that's right.
And as we looked at your background stuff, you really kind of group in this big category of you research chronic wasting diseases in the elderly.
Yes.
Can you
right.
help us unpack that a little bit as to what that means?
Well, the loss of body weight and muscle mass that often occurs in patients with diseases like COPD, heart failure, cancer, and then cystic fibrosis.
And I think people don't appreciate the fact that when people have those kind of diseases that they start to lose muscle mass.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a very interesting to know that, for example, in the world of COPD, that's already known for a long, long period of time, whereas, and for example, in cystic fibrosis, I mean, it's still not clear for a long time. And that's the reason why we added an extra research line to it to actually implement all the knowledge we know from other diseases like COPD also to benefit the cystic fibrosis, which muscle wasting is a huge problem too, but it's not really acknowledged so far.
So why is it a huge problem? Why does it matter if we lose muscle mass?
Muscle mass is a problem, particularly in these diseases, because it really affects your life. Mm. First of all, I mean, these patients have lower muscle function, muscle strength, physical activity level, but it also affects them when they are sick. So when these patients, for example, are admitted to a hospital because of an exacerbation, so a lung infection, then they will stay in the hospital for a longer period of time. So hospitalization stay is longer, they have more complications, the quality of life is lower, and they die sooner. And this is applicable not only to COPD, but also to CF, heart failure, cancer, and so on. So muscle mass is important. I mean, muscle mass, you need to preserve in order to live longer and better.
Now, that's probably coming as somewhat of a surprise to people, because that's not what you hear about when you hear about people that have COPD or cystic fibrosis. You never talk about the muscle wasting side of that. Is there, and that's your general research area, is how to prevent that, I understand. So is that wasting due to the fact that they're just laying in bed? Is it bed rest related? Is it disease related? And then I'm, of course, going to ask about how we can fix it, if we can fix it.
Of course, like you mentioned, physical inactivity is a problem in these patients, and particularly in COPD. You know, when you have a lung obstruction and you are short of breath, I mean, you don't want to walk. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a part. But there are multiple factors involved. And first of all, you have the energy, the negative energy balance, which means that your energy expenditure is higher than your energy intake by the food. And the reason why you have a higher energy expenditure in your daily life is because the work of breathing already costs more energy. And besides that, the respiratory, it's also the muscles. You know, the muscle work more inefficient, so you use more energy during daily life activity. So just the walking, just being active already costs a lot of energy. So that's one part of the equation. So it's the energy disbalance, but also on, there's an effect on protein and mass, and of course muscle consists of protein. Mm-hmm. So there's a negative protein balance too, which indicates that, you know, there are a lot of factors involved in these patient groups, like the inflammation that directly affects your muscle mass, but also hypoxia, which is present in these patients during daily life and during physical activity. And of course medication, corticosteroid use plays a role. So it's multidimensional. There's so many factors involved, all leading to loss of muscle mass.
So you talked about the energy output side of things. Do these patients generally eat less as well on the energy input side? Is that another factor? Is that the dietary factor, they may not eat as much or eat what they should be eating? Or?
Well, in general, when they are stable, the energy intake is fine. And protein intake is also fine. But the problem is the moment when they are not feeling fine. For example, when they have a respiratory infection. You know, when you don't feel good, I mean, you start to eat less. So at that moment, your energy balance is more affected also by reduced energy intake in addition to your increased energy expenditure. So, but in general, you know, right now we do not know exactly how much they really need when they are stable, but also particularly during an exacerbation, because their energy intake needs to be increased and also their protein intake needs to be increased in order to preserve that balance, and that's not always the case.
Yeah, and that's a topic that you have done work on, you're continuing to do work
yes,
on.
Yes, exactly.
How much protein intake do they need? Is there any special supplements that they can take, et cetera? So what's kind of the current thinking in your line of work about how much protein someone needs if they have one of these disease processes?
Well, right now, as I mentioned, in CF world, it's not so much already, generally accepted that protein is a problem, although we're really working hard to change that perception.
Right.
In COPD, of course, we already know for a longer period of time that there is something wrong. But, how much protein you need, it's still not well established. I mean, we are developing techniques right now to be able to assess protein requirements and by using stable isotope techniques. And not many groups in the world are actually using stable isotopes to be able to measure that. So I think that's a nice way of getting more information about it. What we think based upon other diseases is, for example, that in the healthy elderly, there is already a protein requirement of between 1 and 1.2 gram per kilogram body weight per day, and that for a stable patient, it will be a little bit higher, between 1.2 and 1.5. In case they have an exacerbation, inflammatory exacerbation, this will even increase above 1.5. So that's what we expect, and of course, we still need to do more research on that.
And that's a little bit higher than the recommended daily intake for just adults, for healthy adults, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, now the recommended intake is 0.8. But, when you talk to the experts in this field, 0.8 is far too low.
No, right.
So you really are already in healthy elderly in 1.0 at least.
So as you get older, eat more protein.
Exactly.
More protein. Yeah. So you talked a little bit about some of the studies that you're doing with the stable isotopes, and it's really cool technology. But an arm of this, and we were chatting a little bit before we started, was that because you're doing this in humans, and you're often doing this in a disease population, people that have COPD or people that have cystic fibrosis, and oftentimes elderly subjects as well.
Yeah.
And you're doing this all in what we call a bed rest model. So can you tell folks a little bit about the bed rest model, and when we talk about that kind of research, what are you talking about?
You mean the studies we are doing in these disease patients?
Sure, yeah.
I mean, in general, what we do is we ask them to participate in a study in which will last sometimes 3 hours, but also sometimes 5 hours, and they just lay on a bed, and we infuse stable isotopes of amino acid because we are mainly interested in the protein metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they arrive, they are in a fasted state and they lay on a bed. And what we actually do is we take some blood samples and then we are able to measure how much of the protein is synthesized and build up, as well as how much of the protein is broken down. Because that actually, the difference will provide you whether you are a catabolic state, whether you are losing muscle mass or not. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can expect when you are in a fasted state, I mean, when you didn't get a meal, I mean, you lose muscle mass. But it's possible that, for example, patients with chronic diseases have already in the fasted state and a more negative protein balance. So that's what we do. And then subsequently, they get a certain nutrition, certain protein meal, and then we can see whether they respond anabolic to that nutrition, which is, we expect, of course, that protein buildup will be larger than protein breakdown, but you can actually measure how good they respond to that nutritional supplement and whether when you change your protein intake, whether it will actually improve it. And so far, we have done that in COPD, but also in cystic fibrosis. And of course, you need to put an IV in. So what we did, for example, in the cystic fibrosis kids, because those are pediatric children, that we did the study in the hospital when we were admitted for an exacerbation, because they already had a line in place, so we don't have to
do anything extra, right?
And then it's much easier. And, you know, you really get a nice relationship. It's an easy-going study. I mean, you take some blood sample, you chat with them, and they take a supplement, and then you measure the response to the supplement. And it gives you a lot of valuable information, because normally when you provide patients some proteins and you want to see whether it actually will lead to muscle buildup, it takes a long time before you can actually detect it by body composition techniques.
Yeah.
And this is actually in a study in which you do a couple of hours, as I mentioned, and you really get the samples will be analyzed by the lab, and you get indication, okay, will it actually lead to anabolism, and how much anabolism will it lead to? Yeah.
Neat.
So it's a nice, easy, but still not easy, because, of course, you need some expensive.
And the thing is that many times that those of us in the research field, we think these things are easy because we do them every day. And we've worked hard to put them together, and we've gotten all the approvals and so forth. But if you step back, you go, when we talk to the public, we realize that they really aren't that easy.
No, and you know, that's also, that you can also relate it to the fact that there are not many research groups in the world doing this type of studies, because not only, I think the practical things, it's not that difficult, I think, but it's more, you know, the whole knowledge about isotopes, but also to be able to analyze it in the enrichment in blood in the biomass pack. I think just the combination of all these items that makes it...
Makes the research side difficult.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and then you have the recruitment issue, because, again, you're recruiting people who are already sick in many cases.
Absolutely.
Or have issues.
Absolutely.
So what kind of obstacles do you run into when you start working in these kind of populations?
Of course, you first have to meet them. I mean, you have to build a relationship with physicians, because, you know, when you place an advertisement, I mean, you never get a lot of responses back. So you often have to build up a relationship with a physician, go into the clinic, talk to subjects. And it's very interesting. The moment they get to know you and they participate in one of the studies, they will come back because they like it. They like the intention, but also they like to get more information about, you know, how they feel and why they feel and what kind of advertise they can get, advice they can get on their nutritional intake, protein intake. So that really establishes a kind of relationship. So when you have them here, they come back. So that's wonderful. But still, it's difficult. So can you imagine when you do a research study in cancer patients undergoing chemotherapy? These people, you know, just get a bad diagnosis. They don't feel well. And to be able to participate in the study, I think the recruitment is probably the biggest issue in doing human clinical research.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some of your presentations that you've done in the past with some of the breast cancer patients that you've worked with, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
I salute you and your research team for actually finding these patients. But these are patients who have been under anesthesia for 8-9 hours, to be taking data on them, that's really difficult stuff.
Yeah, and you need to have very flexible research staff, because, you know, you have to be there day or night or in the weekend or whatever, because your schedule is dependent upon what's going on with that. I mean, you want to be flexible in order to be able to include them in the study. And even, for example, sometimes you have to change your study protocol a little bit to improve your recruitment.
Right.
But at the end, I think it's really worth it, and that it takes time. I mean, when you start a human study, I mean, first of all, not only get the money in, you also have the IB approval, you then start to set up. You need a certain group of people who will help you with doing the study. And And then subsequently, you know, you have to, the patient needs to show up, and then you have to, you know, it's a long process. It's many, many years of doing, to finish one study instead of doing it, for example, with some of the animal studies. It's shorter, of course, but...
So I guess that's the other messages is that this is not, these are not studies that you think of in the morning and then do in the afternoon.
No, absolutely. It requires a lot of preparation, right. A lot of thinking, and...
And as you mentioned briefly, you have to go through the approval committees here at the university. There's federally mandated human subjects committees that you have to get approval for. Yeah. So research, take-home message, research is not easy, right?
I think research is not easy, but I think translational research, what we are doing, you know, actually provide us information that's not only worthwhile for the scientists, but also for the patients. And that's one of the things we always enjoy to do is also, for example, go to the community and talk to elderly or talk to patients or even parents of cystic fibrosis, but also to CPD patients and just talk about the results. And they're very happy to say, okay, what can I mean? Mm-hmm. What can I do for myself to improve my health? And that's what it's all about. So it's double worth it to go through that hoop.
But when they're engaged like that, then they're more passionate about helping you understand, and then you can help them understand as well.
Absolutely.
So speaking of that passion, one of the things that we talk to our guest about often is why they got into what they're doing. Was there some point in your life that you remember thinking back, you know, I'm really interested in respiratory issues, or I put that another way, how did you wind up where you're at now?
Yeah.
From a little girl, did you? You grew up 7 years old. I want to work on respiratory diseases, look at amino acid balance. Or?
No, not really. Actually, I was also always interested in disease states. So, I mean, I studied movement sciences, so a lot of exercise physiology. But still, I was always interested in the people who are more physically limited. So that's the reason why I signed up for an internship. At the Department of Respiratory Medicine to work with COPD patients and muscle loss. So that's my first introduction. It was already in 1992, but that was the first step. And also when I worked later as a research associate in the Dr. Kalman Wasserman lab, besides just the cardiopulmonary exercise testing, there was also one of the investigators, he well known, Dr. Richard Casterbury. He's doing also studies in COPD. So actually, it did more like lactic threshold exercise testing with him. And, you know, that was a nice follow-up on the study I was doing in Maastricht. And when I came back to the Netherlands, I started my PhD also in COPD, more looking at protein metabolism, so more the underlying disturbances of muscle loss. And when we went to Little Rock, Arkansas, I mean, then it was a nice possibility to also include the CF and the cancer, you know, because what I mentioned, there's so much knowledge available in one disease state. I mean, you really would like to check whether it's also present in the other. I mean, you can learn so much from the other diseases. I think nowadays, unfortunately, that's not often done. And because you can learn a lot by improving the health by just looking to what's already found in different diseases. Of course, you have differences among diseases, but you can also learn a lot from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always respect individuals who make a big leap and move countries to pursue their passion, whether it be research or whatever. And certainly that was a big move from the Netherlands to Arkansas. And then subsequently down to Texas A&M. So what drove that? Was it just opportunity, or was it interest in what was going on in the United States? Or
no, it already helped that I already stayed for a year. I spent a year in Los Angeles, so I knew how it was to live here in a research community, live in the States and be away.
But that
from
was
home
in
home.
Los Angeles compared to
that was Los
Little
Angeles.
Rock, Arkansas.
Exactly, but you know, at that moment. My husband and I had three kids, so I think we prefer it more than
the Little Rock, Arkansas,
the big city of Los Angeles, although I had a wonderful time over there. But so that opportunity came available to work at the Department of Geriatrics and also set up a Center for Translational Research and working there with, so we had to start our research again, you know, doing human research in COPD, and that time also the cancer was involved, breast cancer, lung cancer, and so on. So, it was was a step, but in general, I think it's a very positive. And also for the kids, I think it's wonderful for them to have an opportunity to go abroad and see how loud it is at a different place, in a different country, in a different language, and yes. So on. So I think they're more national and excellent. Yeah, we like it a lot.
It's a broadening experience, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, I'm getting the signals that we're starting to run out of time. And regular listeners of the podcast will know that this is the opportunity that we always give our guest to give us their take-home message. What if there's one thing you want our audience to remember from what we've talked about today, what would that message be?
When you have a chronic disease, always be prepared, which means that, you know, when you have a normal body weight or you feel fine, always take good care of yourself with respect to nutrition, protein, and exercise so that you're prepared in case that, you know, like everybody, something happens in a surgery or you break something, or in the case of a lung patient, get an exacerbation, that you have your reserves because you need it. It's very difficult the moment you lose your muscle mass to actually rebuild it again. Mm-hmm. So you have a real effect on yourself by just taking care of your body by good protein and exercise.
Don't take your muscles for granted, huh?
Absolutely.
Fabulous. Well, Mariella, thank you so much for being here today with us. We've enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. It was really a pleasure, Tim.
And for all those of you that are listening, thank you so much for taking the time to download and listen to us today. If you're a regular listener, you know at this point in the program, we have a podcast question of the week. And here with our podcast question of the week is our producer, Aylin Letzinger.
What is a general recommendation for protein intake for older populations?
Great podcast question of the week, Aylin. Thank you. Be the first person to send us an email with the correct answer to that, and you'll win one of our nifty podcast T-shirts. And so, once again, thank you, Mariella, for being with us. Thank you all for listening. And one last note here. Make sure that you check out the website. We are now have the Huffines Institute apps that are both available for Apple products and for Android products, and tablets and phones as well. So make sure you hit those and download the Huffines Institute apps so you'll know when we have new content up. Until next week, we hope you join us again next week for another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until next week, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Aylin Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.